Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Normally, when you get sick, you do everything you can to avoid picking up the same virus yet again. Except when you're a bank. Then you go looking for that virus on the cheap. And the government encourages you to buy it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done online at elance.com. And by the First 5 Years Fund, working to expand early learning for the nation's most at-risk children and provide benefits for society, ffyf.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess of England in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this Wednesday. It is the first day of July. We've been talking a lot on this program about those so-called troubled assets weighing on bank balance sheets. Distressed loans, mortgage-backed securities, all those arcane financial products we've come to know and not love. Well, this week, the Treasury Department is expected to announce details of its plan to get banks to unload some of those assets. So we were surprised to hear from the Federal Reserve that rather than unloading, some are actually loading up on the very things that got them in trouble. Our New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott has the details.
Mortgage-backed bonds have been blamed for kicking off the financial crisis. So you may be surprised to hear that big banks have increased their holdings of certain securities by more than 5% since April. Why would they be buying this stuff just as the government is trying to get them to sell assets? Leo Tillman has one idea.
These securities are extremely cheap.
Tillman runs an advisory firm that specializes in risk management. Most of these bonds are still paying interest, and Tillman says some are trading at a 25% discount. He says banks figure they can buy them cheap now and sell them at a profit when the economy recovers.
Unless we go into a double-dip recession or some kind of highly adverse environment, you can probably capture significant price appreciation.
Banks may also be betting on a bump from the Treasury's public-private partnership. The plan is meant to entice private investors to buy troubled securities. Linus Wilson teaches finance at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. He says if the partnership creates more demand for the bonds, the banks could make a quick profit.
It might lead to higher prices, maybe temporarily higher prices, and they could make money from that.
Wilson says the banks are taking a risk. They're likely buying the highest quality bonds, but mortgage defaults are expected to keep rising. Still, he says, by buying those risky securities, banks are helping revive the mortgage market. The greater the demand for mortgage-backed bonds, the more likely lenders are to make new loans.
That will make it easier for Americans to get homes.
The Federal Reserve says it's keeping an eye on what the banks are buying. In some cases, it's even stepping in to make sure banks manage the risk properly. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Let's not leave the banks just yet. Today, the industry announced it will oppose the Obama administration's efforts to create a new consumer protection agency. It would regulate financial products like mortgages and checking accounts. But how can banks stop it when they're still on the government dole? Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
In the first 3 months of 2009, financial services firms and their representatives in Washington spent $110 million on lobbying. But as big as that number is, it's less than last year.
Well, they still are among the leaders, and that really hasn't changed.
Dave Leventhal is at the Center for Responsive Politics. He says lobbying is only one way to reach lawmakers. And when it comes to political contributions,
They're right on top with $20-plus million, a number that's only going to grow as we get closer and closer to midterm elections.
But some big industry lobbying associations, like the mortgage bankers, are hurting, even laying off staff. Scott Talbot is at the Financial Services Roundtable.
Banks, financial institutions, like everybody else, are suffering under this economy. And so as a result, belts are worn a little bit tighter and cuts have to be made.
Talbot says this will make the fight against a financial consumer protection agency even harder.
If you say you're against this consumer protection regulator, then people will incorrectly assume that you are against protecting consumers. There is a political will to get this done. So it's going to be an uphill battle to stop it altogether.
But all this doesn't mean bank lobbyists are giving up or that they're powerless. The industry's strategy is simple. They'll try to hold together Republican opposition to this idea in the House and Senate, and then they'll attempt to pick off a few Democrats by offering to strengthen consumer protections that already exist. They'll also argue that creating a new Financial Product Safety Commission would just add a new layer of bureaucracy. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger declared a fiscal emergency today. Last night, politicians in Sacramento failed to resolve a $24 billion budget deficit. As we mentioned yesterday, that means the government will start paying out billions of dollars it owes to state vendors in IOUs. As Sarah Gardner reports, the lack of cash could put hundreds of small businesses in jeopardy.
John Riley says the state of California owes his company more than $450,000 for computer security services. The co-owner of Sacramento Technology Group is bracing for a big IOU instead of cash. Riley says if their bankers don't honor that IOU, his company may be forced to stop doing business with California, and that'll hurt. The state accounts for half his company's sales.
Right now, we're kind of holding our breath.
Riley says his company's already reduced its workforce from 20 to 13 employees because of the recession, and he doesn't want to cut any more jobs.
So we're just hoping that some of our private customers come through with some more projects.
As of this afternoon, only one lender had promised the state it would cash the IOUs. If banks refuse, thousands of the state's private vendors will be forced to beg for more credit. And in this economic climate, that can be tough. Mike Murphy runs a day program for developmentally disabled adults in Orange County. He's counting on the state vendor that contracts with him to get a line of credit to tide itself over.
If they cannot secure that, then we're probably going to have an extended summer vacation.
In other words, they'd have to close. When asked today if he had a message for vendors like Mike Murphy, State Controller John Chung addressed elected officials instead.
The most important point is that the governor and legislature have only a final few moments to resolve this issue.
If they don't, California will start issuing IOUs tomorrow afternoon, the first time in 17 years. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Wall Street got some bounce back in its step today, despite another drop in construction spending. We'll have details when we do the numbers. If you are lucky enough to dine in France, as of today, it's supposed to be a little cheaper. The value-added tax, or VAT, on restaurant meals dropped from almost 20% to 5.5%. Vive la France! Restaurants had argued for years that they were required to charge more in taxes than their faster food brethren. The catch is that the restaurants can kind of choose how much, if any, of that new tax discount to pass along to customers. We decided to check in with a restaurant owner in Paris to find out what this means from plate level. Mark Williamson is a British transplant to the City of Lights. Mark, tell us a little bit about your place and where you are.
I have Willy's Wine Bar here in Paris, which I started in 1980. And I also have a restaurant next door to Willy's, which is rather bigger. And they're both in the center of Paris, not very far from the Louvre or the Place de Victoire or the Comédie Française or the Opera. So, I mean, where I am is the center of the world.
Oh, of course it is. Of course it is. All right. Well, now that I'm thoroughly ready for flying over to Paris for dinner, let's talk a little bit about this change in the VAT tax. Why were restaurants being taxed so highly in the first place?
It's something I think that sort of crept in. If you go back to the 70s when there wasn't any fast food, you'll find that restaurants had a level of tax that was whatever it was. It was probably 17.6%. And they had a lower rate of tax on traiteur, which are places where you go and take food out. And slowly but surely, I mean, with the, you know, second arrival of McDonald's and various other things, the amount of business that was being done, should we say, you know, out of the home, but not in restaurants, grew and grew and grew. And restaurants were at a complete disadvantage.
So it really is, it was kind of restaurants versus Le Big Mac.
Restaurants versus the Big Mac and versus any kind of form of takeout meal.
So is this really then a matter of fairness?
It's definitely a matter of fairness.
So are you expecting that this will help you out with getting more business revenues up?
It'll certainly add to the short-term competitivity of restaurants. You know, for the next 6-8 months, there'll be, you know, adjustments with people looking to see what their neighbors have done, et cetera, et cetera. And we've personally, I mean, we've just gone ahead and passed on the tax breaks to our client base immediately.
All right. So if I were lucky enough to win the lottery today and buy myself a trip on a private jet over to Paris, what would you recommend off of your menu and what would the price be today?
Are you talking about the wine bar or the restaurant?
Oh, let's go with the restaurant. I'm in Paris after all.
Right. What we did in the restaurant is we have a special seasonal menu, which at the moment is strawberries and tomatoes, which means the whole menu is kind of invaded with these products from start to finish. Now, that menu was €48 until this morning. It is now €42.30.
Okay, well, I'm going to go out and buy my lottery ticket right now, and hopefully I'll see you tonight.
You probably won't get there for this evening, but this is an ongoing thing. You'll be able to get here by the weekend, and of course, we'd be very happy to see you.
Sounds divine. Mark Williamson is the owner of Willie's Wine Bar in the heart of Paris, and we've been talking about the drop in the VAT tax there. Thank you so much for your time. Au revoir and bon appetit.
It was a pleasure talking to you.
If you live in a big city, like the City of Lights, and you feel like things are even more cramped than usual, it is not your imagination, at least here in the U.S. Today, the Census Bureau reported that the flight to the burbs is reversing itself, partly because of the economy. But the numbers are, of course, population estimates. They miss a lot of people. A nonprofit organization called Social Compact is trying to change that. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Social Compact's researchers are like inner-city bloodhounds. They sniff out people who are overlooked by the census. John Talmadge is CEO of the Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit.
We conduct research in urban areas throughout the United States in order to assess what the missed market opportunities are. So we find that missed population, the missed income.
Conventional estimates put Miami's population at around 420,000. In its analysis, Social Compact counted more than 500,000. And it uncovered more money, too, over $1 billion in uncounted income. Its detective work focuses on poorer minority neighborhoods, which tend to be undercounted by the census. Social Compact sifts through more than 30 types of public and private data, things like utility bills, which can give clues about how many people live under the same roof. Talmadge says researchers estimate underground cash economies by considering things like
what percent of the households pay their primary bills, their utility bills, on credit versus cash? How many check cashing facilities are there in community?
City leaders often use Social Compact's data to attract new businesses to areas considered too risky or poor to support economic development. That's what happened in the Columbia Heights district of Washington, D.C.
This is a thriving urban neighborhood in a place where there wasn't one before.
That's Steve Moore, president of the Washington, D.C. Economic Partnership. He says a Social Compact study identified 50% more people living in Columbia Heights than were found by the census. The study also uncovered about 30% more income. The report helped Moore market the district to businesses.
It just revolutionized all of our thinking about how to bring it to market, how to talk about it with retailers, sort of what our own strategies ought to be going forward.
In the last few years, retailers like Target, Starbucks, and Bed Bath & Beyond have opened in the area.
Social Compact study, known as a drill down, also helped attract a new bank. Natalie Abetamarco is with Citigroup.
By using the analytics and the information that we got from the Social Compact drill down in D.C., we were able to open up a branch that is actually operating very successfully and profitably.
Social Compact charges between $75,000 and $100,000 for its reports. Foundations usually pick up most of the bill. So far, the nonprofit has studied 20 cities, including Toledo, Ohio. A few years ago, the census estimated that Toledo's population was shrinking. Cardi Finkbeiner is Toledo's mayor.
First of all, you don't want to be seen as a city in decline in any way, shape, or form, including population. Secondly, you wish to get as many federal dollars as you possibly can do.
184 different public programs rely on census numbers when distributing federal money. Mayor Finkbeiner used Social Compact's data to challenge the census estimate.
Lo and behold, the Commerce Department acknowledged in the Census Bureau that there were roughly 23,000 additional Toledoans that had been undercounted.
Detroit and San Francisco have also used Social Compact's data to challenge census estimates. Again, John Talmadge.
So when we had 48,000 people added back to the population of Detroit, for example, they will see over the next couple of years that it rotates in $100 million of additional federal revenue.
In preparation for the 2010 census, mayors in several cities are using Social Compact's reports to help ensure the headcount in their inner cities is accurate. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
And for more of our coverage on how the recession is affecting people's lives, go to marketplace.org and click on The Big Shift. Coming up, helping homeowners stay afloat.
Some homeowners will just send you an email, thank you so much. My kids have a place to sleep at night. And I mean, that's good enough for me, you know.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street made a strong start to what was the first day of the year for many companies. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 0.2%, 57 points, to close at 8,504. The Nasdaq clawed back 0.5%, 10 points, to finish at 1845. And the S&P 500 ticked up 0.4%, 4 points, landing at 923. A lot of the lift in the market came from Kraft Foods. The food company's stock leapt more than 5% on news of a possible expansion in Russia. And General Mills followed, rising 3.8%. Sara Lee ticked up 0.2%. Yum Brands, the parent company of KFC and Pizza Hut, gobbled up 5% as analysts gave its China operations a thumbs up. PepsiCo fizzed up 2.8%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.54%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. How many people are unemployed? The Labor Department releases the June employment figures. Another economic indicator, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for May. Tired of fireworks? If alien abduction is what you're looking for, the Roswell UFO Festival is the place to be. Dress up. It goes all weekend. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. It is the first day of a new quarter today, and we can only hope that the springtime green shoots we saw in the economy continue to flower through the summer. But will the recovery, when it comes, be V-shaped or U-shaped? That is the hot debate among pointy heads who think we're near bottom right now. But today's commentary from Robert Reich is brought to you by another letter, X.
The V-shapers are the optimists who look back at prior recessions and conclude that the faster an economy drops, the faster it gets back on track. And because this economy fell off a cliff last fall, they expect it to roar to life early next year, hence the V-shape. Unfortunately, the V-shapers are looking back at the wrong recessions. Focus on those that started with the bursting of a giant speculative bubble, and you see slow recoveries. Because asset values at bottom are so low, investor confidence returns only gradually. That's where the more sober U-shapers come in. Personally, I don't buy into either camp, because in a recession this deep, recovery doesn't depend on investors. It depends on consumers, who, after all, are 70% of the economy. And this time, they got really whacked. Until consumers start spending again, you can forget any recovery, V or U-shaped. Problem is, they won't start spending until they have money in their pockets and feel reasonably secure. But they don't have the money, and it's hard to see where it will come from. They can't borrow. Their homes are worth a fraction of what they were before. So say goodbye to home equity loans and refinancings. Unemployment continues to rise, and number of hours at work to drop. Those who can are saving. Those who can't are hunkering down, as they should. Eventually, consumers will replace cars and appliances and other stuff that wears out, but a recovery can't be built on replacements. Don't expect businesses to invest much more without lots of consumers hankering after lots of new stuff, and don't rely on exports. The global economy is contracting. My prediction, then? Not a V, not a U, but an X. This economy can't get back on track because the track we were on, for years, featuring flat or declining median wages, mounting consumer debt, and widening insecurity, not to mention increasing carbon in the atmosphere, simply cannot be sustained. The X marks a brand new track, a new economy. What will it look like? Right now, we just don't know.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. Your thoughts? Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. Homeowners who are seriously underwater on their loans might still be able to grab onto the government's life raft. The Obama administration is expanding its mortgage rescue efforts to include borrowers who owe up to 25% more than their home is worth. So far, the Making Home Affordable program has received mixed reviews. People looking for help say they are subjected to a maze of automated messages and less than informed answers when they call their banks. Tamara Keith tells us what it's like on the other side of the line at the nation's largest loan servicer.
Bank of America has 14 call centers around the country. This is one of the largest. It's in Simi Valley, California, two stories with wall-to-wall cubicles as far as the eye can see. This building used to be part of Countrywide, a lender that became synonymous with subprime predatory lending.
Thank you for calling the Home Retention Division. My name is Matthew. Can I ask who I'm speaking with today?
Matthew Coriel is on the front lines at what is now called Bank of America Home Loans, which gets about 80,000 calls daily. He answers about 30 a day. The callers are under a lot of stress. Sometimes they yell or they cry. But Coriel has gotten used to it.
If you treat them right and just keep like an even, you know, a nice tone with them, what I've noticed is that the ones that are so appreciative at the end of the calls, that are overly, you know, really thanking me, are the ones that were many times really upset with me when they first called in.
Here's the thing, though. If you're having trouble paying your loan, Matthew Coriel isn't really the guy you want to talk to. He just gathers information, gives out fax numbers, and transfers calls. The people on the workout team are the ones who can change the terms of a loan.
My name is Zach Harrod. Been with the company for, it's going to be 6 years in October.
Harrod is one of more than 7,000 people at Bank of America now working in the Home Retention Division. The department has nearly doubled its staff in the last 8 months.
Calling in regards to the modification on your loan. Just kind of wanted to go over the terms with you.
Harrod is working the file of a man who lives in Las Vegas.
He's actually currently 9 payments behind. So he's actually in foreclosure, which typically when we get the loan, we'll put the foreclosure on hold during the review process to, you know, allow us time to see what we can do.
Modifying a loan isn't easy. Bank of America may collect the checks, but most of the loans have been packaged into securities and sold off to investors. For a modification to work, it needs to be something the borrower can afford and the investor can tolerate. Information about the customer's income and expenses is plugged into a computer program called HomeSaver. The software weighs things like how much the home is worth and what would happen to the loan if the interest rate is reduced. Bank of America officials say most often changing the terms of the loan is a better deal for everyone than a foreclosure. Herod sees it another way.
It's more just finding the best deal for the homeowner. Really, I mean, really, that is my goal.
This sounds like a whole lot of positive spin from a guy who worked for one of the most notorious subprime lenders. Before Countrywide was taken over by Bank of America, it put thousands of people into loans that were destined to fail. But when Herod says he's here to help people, you want to believe him. He says things are different now. As the economy has gotten worse, the investors have gotten more receptive to cutting interest rates, changing the loans so borrowers can actually pay them back.
They're doing a lot more today, to be honest, than when I started doing this a year and a half ago. A lot more.
And so the man from Las Vegas will see his payments cut dramatically. Herod is moving him from a nearly 8% interest rate on a 30-year mortgage to a longer 40-year loan with a lower rate.
He's down to 2.25 for a year, and then he steps up 1% at a time each year up to 5.25.
Herod has been working a lot of overtime and weekends, and his desk is never clear. But he says it's rewarding.
Some owners will just send you an email, thank you so much. My kids have a place to sleep at night. And, I mean, that's good enough for me, you know.
When he's done with this file, he'll move on to another. Odds are it will belong to someone who's been waiting months for an answer. And there's no guarantee Herod will be able to help them keep their home. In Simi Valley, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, we don't generally take the time to read corporate press releases on the air, but one caught our eye today that seems not only extraordinary, but something of a public service. So here we go. General Motors management has noticed the continuing high trading volume in GM's common stock at prices in excess of $1. GM management continues to remind investors of its strong belief that there will be no value for the common stockholders in the bankruptcy liquidation process, even under the most optimistic of scenarios. The final words from the press release, GM common stock will have no value. Got it? And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 57 points, 2/3 of 1%. The NASDAQ added 10 points, 0.5%. And the S&P 500 gained 4 points, 0.4%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Next time, small seats, bruised knees, gotta love air travel.
Designing for aviation is extreme design. You know, you're 7.5 miles in the air and you're traveling at half the speed of sound.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.